You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Out of Sight by Nick Bilton. There's an old story about Steve Jobs that has become folklore in Silicon Valley. It takes place about 25 years ago in that same nondescript Black Ops building, Mariana 1, where Cook would see the first Apple Vision Pro prototype years later. Back then, in the late 90s, Jobs had a team of engineers building the first iPod. They're toiling away, bending physics, and doing engineering acrobatics to make the smallest prototype of an iPod they can squeeze into a box. Finally, when it can't get any smaller, they take it to Jobs. Now, these prototypes cost millions of dollars, sometimes more, and Jobs looks at it, he inspects it, and he says it needs to be smaller. The engineers say it's as small as it can get, and Jobs walks over to a fish tank and drops the prototype in. Splash! And as it drowns, Jobs says, "You see those air bubbles? That means you can make it smaller. You've got your M2 chip here, R1 chip, near zero latency, 5,000 patents, 7 years," Richard Howarth, the vice president of industrial design, said in a thick Leicester accent as he pointed to the dozens of disassembled components splayed out in front of me, all of which made up the cadaver of the Apple Vision Pro. And yet all I could think about was the fish story and that iPod prototype, and whether Jobs, if he were alive today, would throw the Apple Vision Pro into a fish tank and say, "There's bubbles, make it smaller." If there's one consistent grumble about the Apple Vision Pro, it's about the size and weight. It's around 20 ounces, which might not sound like a lot, because you cook with ounces. You don't necessarily wear them. But that's the same as 5 sticks of butter. Imagine walking around with 5 sticks of butter on your face all day. Carolina Cruz Nera, a pioneer of virtual reality, told me that the way a device sits on your face really impacts how you respond to the technology. "I've been working in VR for over 30 years, and until we can get the scuba diving mask off your face and we make it less noticeable, we're not going to make this a mass adoption technology," Cruz Naira said. "And the size and weight of these scuba diving masks are not going to be solved in a year. It's largely this question that will determine if the Apple Vision Pro will be a financial success. Morgan Stanley anticipates that sales will ramp up to 2 million to 4 million units a year over the next 5 years, and it will become a new product category for the company. But others, like Ming-Chi Kuo, an Apple supply chain analyst, think it's going to remain a niche product for some time. Almost all the analysts I spoke with believe it will eventually get there. We think a few years from now, it'll resemble sunglasses and be less than $1,500. Dan Ives, a senior analyst at the investment firm Wedbush Securities, told me. I didn't even have to ask Howarth about the weight. He brought it up himself. But he did so as he explained that this component and that component are made of magnesium and carbon fiber and aluminum. He pronounced it aluminium, not aluminum, which I respected as a Brit myself. And he noted that these are the lightest materials on Earth and that there is no more diminutive alternative. There's nothing we could have done to make it lighter or smaller, Howarth explained. This is the state of the art. Everyone else I spoke to at Apple proffered a similar sentiment. It feels like we reached into the future and grabbed this product, Joswiak said to me. You're putting the future on your face. As did Rockwell, who told me, we packed just about as much technology as you could possibly pack into that small of a form factor. You can actually lay on your sofa and put the displays on your ceiling if you wish, Cook told me. I watched the third season of Ted Lasso on my ceiling, and it was unbelievable. When I got home and hooked up my own Apple Vision Pro, I watched Ford versus Ferrari on my ceiling. And with the spatial audio, it felt like Ken Miles's Ford GT40 was in the room with me. I think meditation is on a different level than anything I've ever experienced, and I've meditated for a long time, Cook said. I've always had trouble meditating, and he was right about that, too. And I use it for productivity, Cook told me. Typing with the Apple Vision Pro virtual keyboard is a little like trying to write with a pen between your toes. Not impossible, but impractical. But when I opened my MacBook Pro while wearing the Vision Pro, the screen popped into my augmented reality, and I was able to work pretty seamlessly. I'm actually writing these words here, the ones you're reading, on the Vision Pro using the MacBook. And all I can say is I bet if you were watching me now, you'd think I looked just like Tom Cruise in Minority Report, only slightly more handsome. And then there are those spatial videos. I've recorded and watched dozens of spatial videos of my kids just playing and talking, reliving moments that seem mundane, but when played back are so emotionally immersive, it's like stepping into a living, breathing memory. Again, it's hard to describe how realistic the environments feel, but I found myself periodically returning to Mirror Lake, turning off all of my notifications, and just sitting there at the edge of the water, peacefully watching and listening to the rain for 5 or 10 minutes before returning to work. There are plenty of quirks using the device. One of my favorites is when you use the Vision Pro in one room and then go to another, open the same app, and you have to find it by looking all around the room. Sometimes it's on the ceiling or the floor. I couldn't find my text app the other day and turned around to find it was in my bathroom. I later learned you can reset the apps by pressing the digital crown for a few seconds. But the more I've used the Apple Vision Pro over the past 2 weeks, the more one glaring problem revealed itself to me. It's not the weight, which is a problem, but will come down over time, or the size, which will shrink with each iteration, or the worry that it will drive us to consume more content alone. Almost half of Americans already watch TV alone. Or how tech giants like Meta, Netflix, and Spotify are currently withholding their apps from the device. Content creators may come around once the consumers are there, and some, like Disney, are already embracing the device, making 150 movies available in 3D, including from mega franchises like Star Wars and Marvel. And it's not even the price, because if Apple wanted to, the company could subsidize the cost of the Apple Vision Pro, and it would have about as much financial impact as Cook losing a nickel between his couch cushions. I'm talking about something that I don't see a solution for. I first recognized the problem when I was at Apple Park in the basement offices of SJT. I was seeing yet another demo, this time in Joshua Tree, where I sat in the striking desert silhouette of the arid landscape. I played Fruit Ninja, where I got to slice fruit with my bare hands. Then I tried a DJ app, where a turntable opened in front of me, and I could slide the fader, tweak the mixer, and scratch the records, and I summoned a disco ball that magically clung to the ceiling as animated ravers danced around me. In the middle of my DJ set, an Apple employee said it was time to wrap up. I took the Apple Vision Pro off, and that's when it hit me. The problem. It happened again at home, scrolling through the spatial videos I've taken of my kids, seeing them as if they're actually in front of me. And it's going to happen in a few minutes, when I finish writing this article and the Word document in front of me, the size of an IMAX screen, goes away. When I take it off, every other device feels flat and boring. My 75-inch OLED TV feels like a CRT from the 90s. My iPhone feels like a flip phone from yesteryear. And even the real world around me feels surprisingly flat. And this is the problem. In the same way that I can't imagine driving a car without a stereo, in the same way I can't imagine not having a phone to communicate with people or take pictures of my children, in the same way I can't imagine trying to work without a computer, I can see a day when we all can't imagine living without an augmented reality, when we're enveloped more and more by technology, to the point that we crave these glasses like a drug, like we crave our iPhones today, but with more desire for the dopamine hit this resolution of AR can deliver. I know deep down that the Apple Vision Pro is too immersive, and yet all I want to do is see the world through it. I'm sure the technology is terrific. I still think and hope it fails, one Silicon Valley investor told me. Apple feels more and more like a tech fentanyl dealer that poses as a rehab provider. Harsh words, but he feels what we all feel, a slave to our smartphone. And he's seen this play before, and he knows what the first act is like, and the second act, and he knows how it ends. I didn't ask Cook about this, because I didn't realize it all until days later, but I did ask him if technology is moving too quickly, if all of it, AI, spatial computing, and our reliance on technology, if it's just too much. What does the future of it all look like? I asked Cook. I think it's hard to predict exactly, he replied. But you're making it, I said. So don't you get to predict it? What we do is we get really excited about something, and then we start pulling the string and see where it takes us, Cook told me. And yes, we've got things on the roadmaps and so forth, and yes, we have a definitive point of view. But a lot of it is also the exploration and figuring out. He concluded, sometimes the dots connect, and they lead you to some place that you didn't expect. Letting connected dots lead the way was a theme Cook's predecessor used to talk about. The question is the place we're about to go into the era of spatial computing going to make our lives better, or will it become the next technology that becomes a necessity, where we can't live in a world that's not augmented? I think Joswiak had it half right when he said, it feels like we've reached into the future and grabbed this product. You're putting the future on your face. I think it's the other way around. Apple is taking us into the future, into a new era of computing. Some of us are running as fast as we can to get there, and others are being dragged, kicking and screaming. But we're all going. We're going to the moon, and we're going to look around at the ghostly luminescence of ancient dust under a black star-studded sky, and we'll just know that this is the future of computing and entertainment and apps and memories, and that this apparatus wrapped around our head will change everything. the Dean's List. The music industry power couple, Alicia Keys and Kasim Swizz Beatz Dean, have helped lead the way for a generation of collectors of black art. The Rest of the World is Finally Catching Up by Nate Freeman. Photographs by Renelle Medrano. Sittings editor, Nicole Chapoteau. Opening photo shows Keys and Dean with a group of art collectors. In early 2015, the musician Kasim Dean, known as Swizz Beatz, went with artist Kehinde Wiley to see his retrospective, A New Republic, at the Brooklyn Museum. Dean had been churning out hits as a hip-hop producer for more than two decades, propelling singles by the likes of Jay-Z, DMX, Busta Rhymes, and Beyoncé to global inescapability. But Dean, along with his Grammy-winning superstar wife, Alicia Keys, is also a contemporary art patron who caught the bug well before his peers in the hip-hop game. A lot of people used to make fun of me collecting art. I won't say no names, but they're the biggest names, Dean told me recently. We were so hardcore in music. I was a rough rider. Everybody was more in their street element, and so collecting art, he trailed off. Walking through the Wiley Show in 2015, Dean was already itching to move to the next echelon. The loaned works came from institutions all over the country, but also a number of private collectors, a hedge fund executive, a manager at a different hedge fund, the manager of a tech billionaire's family office. Dean realized, reading the wall labels, that he saw no last names of color. Wiley and Dean walked in front of Fembique par un serpent, a 25-foot-long painting of a black man in bed based on a sculpture in the Musée d'Orsay. Courtesy Sean Kelly, New York, its label read, referring to Wiley's commercial gallery. Such wording is often a super insider way to say this might just be for sale. Wiley was hesitant at first. While Dean and Keys were globally famous musicians, they had not put in enough time dancing the art world tango of museum donations, gallery dinner schmoozing, gala hobnobbing, and eyebrow-raising purchases that moves burgeoning collectors up the waiting list. I told him, is this work better off going back into storage or being where we can display your work for the audience that you're saying is lacking, Dean recalled. He paused and looked at his wife, and Kehinde was like, do you know what? I'm going to do it. 9 years later, Femme Piquet par un serpent is back at the Brooklyn Museum as part of Giants, art from the Dean collection of Swizz Beatz and Alicia Keys, a show of nearly 100 artworks. About a third of the couple's total holdings. That's up until July. On a weekday in early February, as the Deans were preparing for its opening gala, I spoke with the couple about their collection's first major museum exhibition and the effort that brought it to being. We've done every single piece of the process, all of the layouts and the whole thing, Keyes said. But the thing that blows our mind the most is that, just like everybody else who's going to walk through these doors, we have never seen this collection hung, ever. As visitors walk into the museum's center pavilion, there's Arthur Jaffa's Big Wheel One, a 7,000-pound sculpture of a tire that rises 17 feet in the air. On one wall is Amy Sherrill's Deliverance, a giant diptych that wowed at Hauser & Wirth during Freeze London 2022. There's an enormous three-part painting by Gagosian-repped multi-hyphenate Titus Kaphar that the couple acquired directly from the artist studio and has never been publicly unveiled. The largest ever work by Meleko Mokgosi, a 21-panel epic, takes up an entire room of the show. There's also a selection of photographs by Gordon Parks and pieces by a grab bag of some of the most exciting artists currently alive, Henry Taylor, Dina Lawson, Toyin Oji Adutola, Micheline Thomas, Jordan Castile, Odili Donald Odida, Derek Adams, and so on. And the first works that greet you as you enter are Portraits of the Collectors by Wiley. I mentioned to Keys that I'd never seen them before. "We've never seen them either," she said. "They're still drying." "They're still wet," Dean added. "We're not joking." Artist Assemble. And this is a photo. Kehinde Wiley's gigantic 2008 portrait was added to the collection after Kasim Swizz Beatz Dean saw the work of the artist at the Artist 2015 Brooklyn Museum survey. And in another photo, Jerome Laguerre, Amy Sherald, Nick Cave, Jordan Castile, Maliko Mokrosi, Nina Chanel Abney, Hassan Hajjaj, Titus Kaffer, Alicia Keys, Kennedy Yanko, Odili Donald Odita, Deborah Roberts, Jarvis Boyland, Zora Opaku, Wiley, Arthur Jaffa, Dean, Chabalala Self, Micheline Thomas, Toyin Oji Odutola, Kelisha Wood, Derek Adams, Hank Willis Thomas. The Deans have built strong relationships with the artists they collect, pictured here, allowing them access to primo works that would otherwise be held for the world's greatest collections. Nicola Vassell, who was the curatorial director of the collection for years and now has her own gallery in Chelsea, attributed their ability to build a world-class collection to the trust and love that the artists have for them. "Say you have a group of 3-4 amazing collectors who could get a work," Vassell said. "Sometimes what shifts the balance is the artist, who they hope can own the work, and the context in which the work will live." The Deans also were collecting black artists, especially black figurative artists, at a time when the art market has started to correct for decades of neglect. Dean was particularly struck by the contrast he saw between visits to the homes of old guard collectors and his peers. It further fueled their collecting. The couple put many of their largest scale works on view at their homes, including a $20 million mansion in La Jolla, California, that is said to have inspired Tony Stark's house in Iron Man 3, and have never sold a work since the inception of the collection. "You have a Bearden, you have a Basquiat, you have this, you have that. You had Ernie Barnes, you had Gordon Parks," Dean told me. "Then I go to my friend's house. They didn't have none of those things." In 2019, Dean and Keys, pictured here, made the Art News' Top 200 Collectors list, the definitive ranking of global art buyers. With it came access to primary market works, usually reserved not for the top 200 collectors, but the top 20. Sources indicated that the waiting list for one of the only 4 large-scale Sherald works at her first show with Hauser & Wirth was enormous, but the gigantic diptych went to the Dean collection. Brooklyn Museum director Ann Pasternak has also had a front-row seat to the Dean's rise. Shortly after taking the job, she was at the Brooklyn Heights townhouse owned by board vice chair Stephanie Ingracia, where she was introduced to Dean. After just a few minutes of talking, she and Ingracia asked him to join the board. "I will tell you that there were artists and others who were really skeptical, who would dismiss them from the get-go as just celebrities, like, what do they have to offer?" Pasternak said. "They have absolutely proven themselves to be true and blue and absolutely committed to the artist in a way that artists all see now, and they all want to be in this collection." In the years since, the couple opened an artist residency in Arizona called Dreamland and an art and music festival called No Commission that pops up at art fairs like Art Basel Miami Beach. In 2019, they staged a selling group show at UTA Artist Space in L.A. called Dreamweavers that consisted partly of work consigned directly by artists. And Gordon Parks, selections from the Dean collection opened at the Ethelbert Cooper Gallery at Harvard. During the COVID-19 lockdown, Pasternak started thinking about putting together a show. They call it the Dean Collection. They imagine it to have its own wing in the museum at some point in the future, she told me. My mind really started to think seriously about doing an exhibition, in part because he and Alicia have used their platforms as artists to celebrate and fight for the rights of other artists with real passion. When the show was announced, there were some grumblings about a major New York institution giving a private collection such cherished real estate. Pasternak dismissed the notion, citing the fact that 30 Americans, a show of work from the collection of Don and Mira Rubel, toured museums for years to great acclaim. In 2019, the Smart Museum at the University of Chicago staged an exhibition of work owned by Pamela J. Joyner and Alfred J. Jafrida. Look at the Louder collection at the Met, right? She said. Both Keyes and Dean were born in New York and became young phenoms at nearly the same time. In Hell's Kitchen, Keyes' mother would play the records of Billie Holiday and other jazz greats, which led Keyes to a classical music education on the piano, and at 21, more Grammy statuettes than she could hold at once. Keyes racked up several more platinum records in the years since. For the rest of time, you will not attend a Big Apple sporting event without her voice reminding you that New York is a concrete jungle where dreams are made of. Dean grew up in the Bronx with a father who was close with DJ Kool Herc at the birth of hip-hop and two uncles who started the influential crew Rough Riders. After starting to DJ at age 12, Dean began messing around with beats at an Atlanta studio in 1998 and showed DMX the beat that would become Rough Riders' anthem, a harbinger of the kitchen sink percussion meets earwormy sonic idiom he has since deployed. The hits bought houses, and suddenly something needed to go on the walls. Dean grew up seeing street art in the South Bronx, where Keith Haring would put up tags. Keyes, too, recalls having a poster of Gustav Klimt's The Kiss on the wall growing up, and later discovered Ernie Barnes through the sleeve of a Marvin Gaye record. For those who don't know that, collecting art is a drug, Dean said. It's a serious drug, and once you get hooked onto the drug, just like any drug, it's hard to get off. By the time Dean and Keyes married in 2010, they were completely devoted to collecting living artists in depth, visiting their studios, consulting them on the installation of the work, and hanging out as much as possible. Vassell, who has worked at Deitch Projects and Pace, pointed the couple toward emerging artists who would soon become young stars, including Nathaniel Mary Quinn, Ebony G. Patterson, and Shabalala Self. Those relationships were on full display at the Brooklyn Museum opening night, where the artists had gathered prior to the arrival of the Board of Trustees and other VIPs. And in more photos, thinking big, the Chicago-based artist Nick Cave is known for his sound suits, so named for the rustling they would make when he wore them. Amy Sherald's monumental diptych Deliverance is one of the largest canvases in the Dean Collection. Deborah Roberts, The Visionary, 2018. The Dean Collection has a number of Barclay Hendricks' underappreciated landscape tondi. The collection has large holdings of photographs by Jamel Shabazz, including this 2011 shot of breakdancers in Midtown Manhattan. Wiley's white-on-white Celine trainers zipped from one end of the room to the other as Dean came out to greet him with a bow, and Keyes emerged from behind a backdrop to yell "Hola" at Nick Cave. Castile came in with Oji Odutola, and as I was chatting with Kefar, he looked ahead and announced, "Oh, the legend just walked in." There was Micheline Thomas. Jaffa came in with Hank Willis Thomas, who was just with Kennedy Yanko and Sherald. Adams approached Nina Chanel Abney with a bit of a stutter step and embraced a number of the artists. Eventually, Jamal Shabazz showed up to snap pictures of everyone. "This is like my Met Gala," said a Brooklyn Museum employee. After a few minutes, Keys clapped and told the artist, "Everybody, please join us downstairs on the first floor for a toast at 6 on the dot. 5:55, actually." The crowd filtered downstairs. Most openings attract a few hundred museum members and guests. Attendance of the invite-only bash would top 1,200, including the artist's cause, Ford Foundation President Darren Walker, and Art Basel CEO Noah Horowitz. Waiters passed around flutes of Hennessy Paradis for a toast, and Pasternak joined Dean and Keys on a riser to address the room. She suggested that before the VIP crowds got to the museum, the artist in the show should join their collectors to see it. Only Dean and Keys and the artist, no curators, no board members, no directors of the museum. "Is that fair?" she asked. It was deemed fair. Dean walked toward the door to the exhibition, with Keys strolling into the show with Ogio de Tola and Castile, the three of them, arm in arm. Turner Classic. In the last few years, English actor Callum Turner has worked with Clooney, Hanks, and Spielberg. So, yes, you could say it's going well. Vanity Fair catches up with Hollywood's latest heartthrob as he takes downtown New York City in style by Kara Warner, with photographs by Matthew Brooks, styled by Nicola Formichetti. Callum Turner, photographed in January in New York City. Being anointed the next big thing is a famously loaded experience, since it could be the springboard to either glory or despair. It's on that precipice that we meet Callum Turner. He's in the midst of an international press tour and chatting over Zoom from a luxury hotel suite, unaware of how many interviews he's completed, or, he jokes, even what day it is. There's an unexpected bit of drama, though, when one of the potato chips he's casually munching on gets lodged in his throat. "Sorry, that crisp just dried out my mouth," he says, reaching fast for a bottle of water. "I don't want to die eating a Pringle. What a way to go." The former Burberry model is fresh off his starring role in George Clooney's holiday sleeper hit The Boys in the Boat, and now promoting his acclaimed performance in Masters of the Air, the Apple TV Plus series executive produced by Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg, and Gary Getzman. There's also a rumored romance with pop star Dua Lipa, which Turner sidesteps, addressing, though when pressed, he admits that his favorite Dua Lipa song is Houdini. Turner is clearly enjoying the ride thus far. "It just keeps getting better," he says. Turner's first high-profile role was in the Fantastic Beasts franchise as Eddie Redmayne's dashing brother, but he proved to have a knack for roguish types as well. In 2020's Emma with Anya Taylor-Joy, he played the distinctly unsuitable suitor Frank Churchill. In Masters, he plays real-life World War II pilot Major John Bucky Egan with swashbuckling panache. "Egan had a real mischievousness about him, and so does Callum," says Getzman. The role required Turner to ditch his British accent for a Midwestern one, which he liked to maintain offset. "The game was to make people think that I was American," he says. Turner is a playful interview subject, doling out genuine sentiment and cheek in equal measure. "My favorite was drinking a lot of whiskey," he says, eyes twinkling. "That helped a lot to get into the character, because that's what Egan was doing. He was dealing with his traumas." Turner was raised by a single mom in one of the only working-class areas of London's posh Chelsea neighborhood. He worked in retail at the age of 15. "My mom got me a job in my rival soccer team's club shop, so I had to wear the tracksuit of Fulham. And I am a Chelsea fan," he says. After a brief stint playing semi-pro soccer, he left home to work as a model in Japan, Italy, and France. At 19, he turned to acting. "I told enough people I wanted to do it. That gave me the fear of not doing it," he says. Turner started taking night classes and later hired an acting coach he's been working with for 11 years now. "He's a movie star," says Getzman. "He's formidable in every way and what you want in an actor, and he's a great guy to have around. Tom Hanks and I never hire for star power, we hire for the part. But over time, you get a sense of who they are and what their range might be in their life of acting, and he's got no boundaries on him." The privilege of working with legends is not lost on Turner, who isn't shy about asking for advice or observing people's methods. They feel a great sense of responsibility, not just for their jobs individually, but for the industry as a whole, he says. "They welcome you into the community, and it's a real pleasure being part of it." Turner was recently cast in A Prayer for the Dying. If superstardom is in his future, he plans on following the Clooney method for staying grounded. George's friends are still his friends from when he was like 18 years old, and even though he's famous, he's the same guy. "If I met George Clooney in 1990, he'd be the same bloke as the man I worked with 30 years later. I'm going to stay the same. Same as George and Tom and Gary. I'm so lucky that I have a wonderful group of friends and family. Even if I thought about getting too cocky, they'd let me know. Just don't ask Turner to row crew again. What we did was so special. Those guys are mates for life, he says, of his boys in the boat co-stars. Also, if I went and rowed on the Thames now, George Clooney wouldn't be screaming at me with a megaphone to do it better. So, it wouldn't be as fun. Something Wicked. Director John M. Chu originally thought unknowns would play Glinda and Elphaba in his adaptation of Wicked, but he had to settle for superstars Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo. Vanity Fair goes on set for an exclusive peek at the beloved musical's big screen debut by Chris Murphy. Opening photos, school days. Ariana Grande as Glinda and Cynthia Erivo as Elphaba photographed during production in London. Never underestimate the power of divas working in tandem. When Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande sign on to a joint Zoom call, they deliver an elongated hi so joyous it overpowers my laptop speakers and knocks the sound out temporarily. It could have been that we were both screaming at the same time, says Erivo. Sorry, we came in hot, Grande adds sweetly. We were excited. Like theater geeks worldwide, they've waited more than 20 years for the Wicked musical to be adapted for the screen. Directors as varied as J.J. Abrams, Ryan Murphy, and Rob Marshall were all reported to have circled the movie at some point. Rumor has it, actors like Lea Michele and Amy Adams did too. For years, Stephen Daldry was attached to direct, but that version fell apart. Why did it all take so long? Having done something well in one sandbox, there's pressure if you're going to do it in the other sandbox, says producer Mark Platt, the engine behind both the Broadway production and the film. Maybe subconsciously I was like, I'm not quite ready for that, emotionally. A prequel to The Wizard of Oz, based on Gregory Maguire's novel, Wicked tells the story of Elphaba, the Wicked Witch of the West, and Good Witch Glinda, before Dorothy, her house, and her little dog, too, landed in Oz. The Broadway show was staggering in scale and included two of this century's most beloved musical theater songs, popular and defying gravity. So the movie's director would need a worthy vision. Enter John M. Chu, the man behind Crazy Rich Asians and In the Heights. Chu is an OG Wicked fan who saw the musical during its pre-Broadway tryout in San Francisco. I remember thinking, oh, wow, it feels like a movie already, Chu says. Or maybe two movies, to give the story room to fly. Chu's Wicked hits theaters this Thanksgiving, with part two arriving a year later. Originally, Chu considered unknowns for the roles Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel made legendary. Instead, the production landed on superstars. Grande playfully admits to stalking Platt to play Glinda. It was literally 10 years of being like, knock, knock, any developments? Is there an audition coming this year or next year? I would like to start preparing today. When the time came, she didn't ease up. Every time she came into audition, she'd be there at least 30 minutes early, says Chu. I'd see her car circling. I'd be like, who is that? That's Ariana Grande. Why is she here so early? Erivo had won an Emmy, a Grammy, and a Tony, but the Brit honestly didn't believe I'd be seen for the role and was one of the last people brought in for Elphaba. Once she got the call, she says, I was training like I was a boxer. After she sang, says Chu, Mark and I looked at each other and we're like, we're done. You might assume that creating Oz would involve excessive CGI. You'd be mistaken. I was like, I want to do it the way I dreamed about it as a kid when I watched Hook, Chu says. Behind the scenes, Steven Spielberg was on a dock with a giant pirate ship. I'm like, if this is my one opportunity to do this, I want to do that. Wicked's yellow brick road came complete with mud, and an actual train transports the witches to the Emerald City. And the singing? These are live vocals, Chu says. When we were shooting, those girls were like, F the pre-records, we're going live. The director was skeptical. There's going to be a lot of wind in your air pipes. Is that okay? He asked. They didn't miss a beat. Yeah, that's what we do. For Defying Gravity, Erivo actually sailed through the western sky, belting high Fs. She had a harness pulling and pushing and yanking and tugging on every nook and cranny that there is, says Grande. Her own numbers were no stroll in the park. I'm literally never going to forget you jumping on a chandelier over my head while singing, Erivo tells her co-star. Grande giggles, remembering the stunt. She was just so excited to perform for her new friend, she says of Glinda. She wanted to do a trick. Jeff Goldblum works more questionable miracles in the film as the so-called Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Bridgerton breakout Jonathan Bailey plays dreamy Prince Fiero, who drives a wedge between Elphaba and Glinda. and Ethan Slater, a Tony nominee for playing the lead in Broadway's SpongeBob SquarePants musical, won the role of Buck with his comedic chops. As for Michelle Yeoh, she made sure Chu understood her limitations before casting her as the headmistress of Glinda and Elphaba School. The director remembers asking his Crazy Rich Asian star if she'd ever do a musical. She's like, "John, I can't sing, but I would do anything for you." The heart of Wicked is Elphaba and Glinda's bond, a friendship between two women scrutinized by a less than forgiving public. When two giant stars come together, you never know what kind of egos come flying out, Chu admits. But Arriba and Grande forged a relationship that changed them for the better. "I just need to say that I don't think people realize that she's got the chops," says Arrivo, grasping Grande's hand. "I don't think people realize how brilliant this person's brain and voice and talent is." Grande turns away, her eyes welling up. She also paid Arrivo a compliment, like the good witch she is. "She's my favorite female voice. When I was watching you sing at the Oscars, I said, I hope someday I get to sing with her. Thank goodness, dreams come true." In more photos, Wicked conjures a remarkable cast of characters, not to mention stars. Fierro, Jonathan Bailey, Nessa Rose, Marissa Bodie, Buck, Ethan Slater, Elphaba, Arrivo, Glinda, Grande, The Wizard, Jeff Goldblum, Madame Moribel, Michelle Yeoh, Fanny, Bowen Yang, and Shen Shen, Bronwyn James. Pictured here, The Wiz with headmistress Madame Moribel. Fierro, a partying prince who attends Shiz University with Glinda and Elphaba, gets romantically entangled with both. All pictured here. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.